And part of the reason, the stated reason for these things was that these were the instrumentalities of fractioning the court and allowing and supporting this pattern of court conduct that you referred to a little bit ago.
Well, I probably lost the vote of every justice of the court except Mike Kavanaugh, and I never had his to start with on anything that I've been in court on. So, you know, but I firmly believed that and was never able to convince anybody that it ought to be done. But to me, it would have been very much better if there had been considerably more time. And the run-of-the-mind stuff that judges of that court do between formal court sessions could be done. Well, I know that I conferred with John Fitzgerald and with Mary Coleman with much more frequency. And I guess I did with Giles Kavanaugh, too, because he was in Lansing a lot more than the others. He felt that his duties as Chief Justice kept him here, and when he'd come in for something else, why, we'd frequently have something to talk about. But you're in the midst of looking at a case, and something strikes you, and you'd like very much to have, in addition to your law clerks to bounce the thing around with, to have another justice to talk it over with, and maybe two or three, so that you wouldn't get just one opinion, but you'd get a couple of different opinions, and I think it would be more constructive. And I frankly think it would improve the speed of the decision-making process. But we don't have it.
Do you see any relevance with the line of thought that you have been articulating, the court, I'll call it fractionated, geographically, much of the time, between that and the fact that when you came to the court, there were four commissioners. Now there are 16 commissioners. Then the staff, including secretaries and law clerks, probably, let's say, if there were seven members of the court, it might have been 17 or 18, and now I suspect, but I don't really know, that let's say there are 30. Is there any connection, or would you have any observations to make about that development?
I don't know whether there's any connection. I know that the work of the court, the number of cases in which appeal is sought, has increased geometrically, I guess. But I know there was a period of time in which I had one secretary and one clerk. Now, there was also a period of time in which I had one secretary and two clerks. As I understand it now, every justice has a secretary and three clerks, and which all goes toward speeding things up and so forth. But another thing, I remember when I went in, I was I didn't have anybody in mind to serve as clerk, and Thomas Matthew Kavanaugh had a couple of clerks. He'd been Chief Justice, but the previous January, Thomas Giles Kavanaugh had been selected as Chief Justice. And one of of my predecessor's clerks was Bob Karras. And I checked with the other justices, and they said that he was a thoughtful, constructive young man who did his work well and so forth. And I thought that I knew his father in the legislature. I knew he came from a Democratic Party background, and I thought probably as clerk to Thomas Matthew Kavanaugh, he'd have a different philosophy than mine. And I thought that would be a good mix, that it would help me in challenging my own predilections to have someone like this on my inner staff. And the only thing I asked of him, I said, I don't want you to change your philosophy or anything else, but I do insist upon loyalty. I said, what we do in this office, I want you to give me the same degree of loyalty that you gave Thomas Matthew Kavanaugh, and if you think you can do that, and if you will tell me you'll do that, then I'd like to have you as one of my clerks. But if you have any doubt about it, now's the time to face up. And he said, no, I can do that. And he did. As far as I know, he was just fine. And he and my clerks always served as a sounding board. I would come back from a court session, and they'd say, well, what do you think of such and such a case? And I would give my preliminary indication, well, I think this ought to be done or that ought to be done. And once in a while, they'd say, yeah, that's the way it looks to us. And once in a while, they'd say, oh, you can't do that, Judge, you can't do that. And I'd say, okay, maybe I can't, but you guys figure out the best arguments you can why I shouldn't, and we'll tackle it in a couple of days. And they reacted as though it were a game, and they ganged up on me. And once in a while, they developed a crack in my thought processes. And every time I ended up agreeing with them, I said, well, you're just selling me a bill of goods. I'm losing my mind. But it wasn't that. It was a more thorough ventilation of the pros and cons of a given position. And I always welcomed being challenged. And then one day in one of our conferences, I remembered Soapy telling me how he selected his law clerks. And the first requirement was that they be philosophically in tune with him. So he had a different approach. He felt that that was more helpful to him. I felt to have somebody philosophically in tune to me was... I wouldn't have minded if one of my clerks had been, and every now and then one was. But it didn't bother me if they weren't. And I welcomed it as a challenging to my own thought process.
That's very interesting. I think that, given the idea of what we're trying to do here is to leave something for the scholars and the students of the judiciary to ruminate about and maybe to be instructed about in the future. I think this is what we're supposed to be doing, or what I conceive to be my...
Well, if you've done something right, hurrah!